Good morning, folks. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to talk about a bunch of different topics throughout the 3 hours that we spend with you. Highest recorded average price today for gas, up 4 cents from yesterday, $4.56 a gallon nationally. Democrats' response, engage in 1970s-style price controls. Remember the lines? Just 23% of economists agree that would reduce inflation. In a University of Chicago initiative on global markets polled, and we are begging again, rumor has it, stories released, for oil from Venezuela. Can you believe that? We're right back at our old games. We'll talk more about that later in the show. Black Lives Matter co-founder finally files the IRS Form 990. You remember the form that triggers her? Wonder why? I think you know and won't be surprised by what's reported. And the World Swimming Coaches Association releases their position on transgender swimming. We'll talk about that issue as well. Also, Mark Hamrick joins us in the 12 o'clock hour, Bankrate senior economic analyst, about the April retail report. Michael Heck, president and CEO of G&O Inc., will update us on the latest business needs and economic impact that we're having with inflation, COVID on the rise, what's happening there. And he brings with him Courtney Williams, founder and CEO of Skills Academy, a training academy that recruits, trains, and places individuals in business-oriented roles in technology companies. Looking forward to that conversation. Joining us now, Rafi Goyeneche, the executive director of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. I got tongue-tied there a little bit, Rafi. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Noel. How are you?
Good, good, good. Couldn't get your name out for whatever reason, but anyway, nonetheless, we move.
That happens a lot. That happens a lot. Yeah.
But Rafi, let's talk about the most recent crime numbers that you guys released as of May 15th, which I think was Monday, in your Orleans Parish Crime Bulletin.
So, you know, this is going to be a downer for your audience, but. You know, they need to know this, and that's why you have me on to share this information. But homicides are continuing to pick up steam. We've had 110. So when we released this report on Monday, there were 109. We've had one since Monday, so it's up to 110. And the change from 21 to 22 is up 45%. Shootings are down this year relative to last year, but that is some caveats, and I'd like to come back to that and explain to your audience why I'm saying that. Carjackings were reported as being up 17%, but since Monday when we released this, there were 123 total on Monday. It is now 128. We've had five since Monday. So that... you know, we issued that report saying that carjackings were slowing down, and we jinxed ourselves, and we've had five of them since Monday. And armed robberies are up 26% this year versus last year. So going back to homicides and shootings, we had 121 homicides for the entire year in 2019. And as of today, we're at 110. So the question is not, are we going to exceed 2019's numbers? We are. We're going to exceed 20's numbers, 22's numbers. So what we're going to see is how quickly we exceed 2019 and 2020 and 2021's numbers. And it's likely that we will surpass the 2019 121 total, possibly by the end of this month, no later than next month. And that's bad news.
Half a year, now, less than half a year.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, homicides, we're counting the actual homicide victims. Shootings, carjackings and armed robberies are incidents. And I know you understand the difference between, you know, that, but incidents don't necessarily identify how many shooting victims there were. So in one incident, there may be multiple victims, but it's counted as one incident. So when we say that shootings are down 9% this year in comparison to last year, that is a little misleading, because what we have seen this year is incidents involving multiple victims. And I'm not just talking about two. You know, we're talking four, five, six people being shot at one shooting incident. So we're seeing the firepower increasing, the numbers of shell casings captured at or recovered at shooting sites and multiple victims. That doesn't mean that the numbers are actually down. While the incidents are down, the numbers of shooting victims, I think, are probably as high or higher than last year. And the difference that we're seeing between this year's combined homicide and shooting incident numbers is that people that are being shot are more likely to be killed this year than they were last year. And I believe that that is a result of some of the firepower that we're seeing at these shooting sites, where it's not just one or two shell casings, but in some instances, dozens of shell casings that are involved in a single shooting incident. So I think the violent trend is high. I think one of the silver linings that we may have in the near future, in June, we're about to start Operation Golden Eagle again, which is when the state police send down a task force to assist and work with the NOPD in proactively policing some of the crime hotspots in the city. And last year, that initiative that goes from June through July helped slow down some of the violence that we had experienced prior to Operation Golden Eagle. So we're bringing that back, and that usually is a successful operation, because you are applying those strategic assets in high crime areas to drive down and identify some of the people that are responsible for committing the violent crime surges that we're seeing around town.
Rafi, the other day, in response to the announcement that was made by the chief and state police and obviously federal authorities, one of the criminologists at Loyola said that they really believe that this plan is not going to work, that it needs to be more about jobs, summer programs, and things of that nature. I made the observation that a lot of the folks that we're getting our hands on and arresting successfully, and the NOPD has had a number of successes in that regard, these aren't folks looking for a summer job. I mean, these are young kids that have been in the business of stealing other people's property. The breadth and depth of their criminal behavior is accelerating for any number of reasons. And I don't think we turn the tide with some of these kids with the offer of a summer job. I just don't see that. I mean, after 40 years, I heard these stories over and over and over again, and having interviewed a number of these kids myself, I don't see that. I don't see that at all.
Well, I mean, again, this is unscientific, but I think that anybody that wants a job, particularly, you know, entry-level employees like high school kids that may be looking for summer employment, I don't think that there is a shortage of jobs that are available. You know, most businesses are hiring, and they're actively advertising for hiring. Fast food outlets, a number of other areas. I mean, so if anybody wants a job and they can get to work, they can pretty much pick and choose where they're going to work. So it's not a shortage of jobs that are availability are available right now. And I disagree with who stated that, particularly when it comes to violent crime. The people that are committing these violent crimes are not going to abstain from committing the violent crimes because they didn't have a job. As you pointed out, their job, their business is, you know, committing violent felony offenses. And the only way to slow that down and reduce that, at least in the immediate future, is to have a law enforcement consequence for the people that are perpetrating these crimes. So a perfect example that I like to cite is the case of Tyrone Steele, who was indicted last month for 5 homicides that were committed in the month of March. Now, he's an 18-year-old, and those are 5 homicides that he committed in a one-month period of time. With him being off the streets, not only have they held him accountable for the 5 homicides that he's been charged with, but they're going back and investigating other crimes that he committed when he was a juvenile, and there may be additional indictments. But maybe even more importantly, now that he's in custody, he's not out on the streets to continue to wreak havoc and victimize additional people. So if law enforcement wants to turn the tide on this, that's why the state police are coming in. If it were so simple as to say all we had to do was to identify jobs for the people that are committing the murders, shootings, robberies, carjackings, you know, the jobs are there. They can go to work. They're not. That's why the state police, that's why the NOPD is launching this initiative to crack down on, identify, and respond to the violent crime hotspots that are well known within the community, but the police department by itself, because of its depleted manpower status, just doesn't have the resources to tackle this without the assistance of the state police. So the state police are absolutely doing a favor, and they've been a wonderful partner to the NOPD, not just during COVID, but, you know, going back decades. They're always there to help New Orleans when New Orleans needs help. And I don't know where we'd be without the assistance of Louisiana State Police supplementing what some of our initiatives are in the city.
Do we have any idea as to numbers, how many folks they're going to be in a position to send down?
No, I don't know what the actual number is. I think it will probably be, you know, augmented some by some of their existing personnel that may be here doing some other work, that are going to be doing some analytical work and assisting the troopers that are deployed in the field. So it's not just the troopers that are going to be out on the streets. There's going to be support assets in the form of analysts and other technology and other resources that the state police are going to bring to the table. And they're going to do this, and they're not charging the city of New Orleans anything for doing this. They're doing this because they realize that, you know, crime is impacting New Orleans, and as New Orleans goes, so goes the state of Louisiana to a great extent.
We got to get to a break. Rafi, when we come back, if you have any thoughts on Representative Debbie Villio's bill about 4 nonviolent crimes and making sure that you serve the sentence that you are given in that regard. Their detractors are saying that that's violative of the reforms that have been put in place over the last several years. We'll talk about that when we return. Rafi Goyeneche, head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. 504-260-1870 on the Oakenheart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us, folks. We're back. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, there's a bill going through the state legislature, House Bill 544, proposed by State Rep. Debbie Villio, a Republican out of Kenner, talking about the number of inmates. And she says there's a third of the prison population right now that is made up of repeat offenders with more than four nonviolent felonies. And the bill proposes to extend the amount of time that they have to serve. Current law provides that they would serve 25% of their sentence. That would be raised to 65%, and they would do so by recalculating good time that's given for these individuals. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's very commonsensical. So, you know, a lot of the reform advocates, you know, were only looking at the offense for which an offender was sentenced to the penitentiary. And they were commenting and basing their position and advocacy for criminal justice reform, saying that these are nonviolent offenders. Why are they in the penitentiary? And what they don't realize is, or they ignored, is you don't get sent to the penitentiary for a nonviolent offense for your first conviction, your second conviction, and in most instances, your third conviction. So you're going to get sent to the penitentiary if you've committed four nonviolent felonies. So if giving someone a second chance didn't work the second time, the third time, and the fourth time, and they were given a probated sentence, and they were afforded opportunities to out-of-custody programs, and that didn't alter their behavior or reduce their potential for recidivism because they came back a second time, a third time, and now this is their fourth offense. They're saying that these offenders are posing more of a risk to the community, and as such, they should not be given the benefit of the good time leniency that the criminal justice reform legislation of 2017 initiated, because they should be treated differently than a first or a second or a third offender. And I think that that is logical and appropriate to recognize that, you know, people that are coming back a fourth time, that the programs and opportunities and second chances that they were afforded didn't work, and they need to be treated a little bit differently. So that doesn't mean that they're going to be locked up and thrown away. They're just not going to receive the benefits of good time at the same rate as first, second, and third offenders are. And I think that most law-abiding citizens recognize that. You know, you have to pay a consequence when you, you know, waste your opportunities for reform. And when you're coming back, every time you come back into the system, it's costing taxpayers more and more money. Not to mention that, you know, property crimes, every property crime has a victim, and that victim is going to be out of pocket. And how many times do you, you know, turn the other cheek and allow that offender to be treated as if he's a first or a second offender when they're a fourth, fifth, or sixth offender? So I think that this legislation is creating some balance and recognizing and distinguishing between the risk that some of these offenders actually pose to the community. And I think it is a reasonable bill, and the Metropolitan Crime Commission supports it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I don't think that this is really eroding the goals of the Louisiana Justice Reinvestment Package of 2017. If after four times, you know, because the current status of good time is you get 13 days of good time for 7 days served. So you serve seven, you get 13 days off your time. And this simply is saying that if you're in there and you have four nonviolent felonies, these are not misdemeanors, these are felonies, and I will remind people that we gave criminals a cost of living increase on felony theft, We moved it to $1,000. Consider the following. In California, it's only $950. You know, we give them more of a benefit of having a misdemeanor charged. And it would change good time from you get one day for every two that you serve.
Exactly.
And, so, and I don't think that to be onerous, because the flip side is what we've done is we've embraced this theft criminality to where people are just, it's a cost of doing business. Okay, so I'm taken out of the loop for a little while.
The other thing that I think that, you know, the average citizen may not realize, and a lot of the farmers don't realize, is that, you know, 98% of the people that plead guilty, you know, are pleading guilty pursuant to a plea deal. Mm-hmm. So you have, quote-unquote, nonviolent offenders that were arrested for a crime of violence, and part of their plea deal was to allow them to plead to a nonviolent felony. So just because they're serving time for a nonviolent felony doesn't mean that they're not a violent felony offender. Doesn't mean that their initial charges weren't violent felonies. I mean, you know, we're documenting in New Orleans that, you know, an unbelievable percentage of the violent crimes that are closed that started out as violent felonies, people aren't pleading as charged. They're pleading to other offenses. And I think that this bill takes into consideration the danger that the offender poses to the community, rather than strictly limiting their position on the offense, not looking at the frequency or the criminal history, or if that felony offense initially started out as a violent felony, but was the offender was allowed to plead to a nonviolent felony offense that would allow them to accrue good time at a greater rate. So this is, I think, creating some balance and recognition that some of these offenders pose a greater risk to public safety than just the offense for which they're in the penitentiary may indicate.
And, you know, it's interesting, and maybe you know, I haven't seen it, and I'll go try and look for it. So we would, if we pass this in 2017, let's say it starts operational in 2018, we have four years of data now, right? Maybe as high as four, maybe just three of data as it relates to recidivism. I got to imagine if the numbers looked really good, we would have heard about it, right?
I would suspect so. You know,
I mean, it's crickets. I've not heard anything.
Yeah. Right, right. Keep in mind that the, you know, reform package that Louisiana offered was initially supposed to replicate what Texas did, but we didn't have the money that Texas had to invest in creating programs for the offenders before we accelerated the good time and parole eligibility date. So what Louisiana did was that we said that we're going to invest any savings from year one into year two.
Right.
So we started to accelerate the release of felony offenders before we created the capacity for the programs to assist them once they were released.
Yep. Did the same thing with juveniles years ago under Landrieu when he was a lieutenant governor. Same exact thing, but it failed.
Right. So I suspect, you know, in the next year or so, we'll probably hear more about what the recidivism rate is in the state. And, you know, we'll be able to better assess how these reforms have gone. But I think that, you know, this bill offered by Representative Villio is recognizing that fourth offenders are posing a greater risk to public safety, and they're being treated differently because the first three attempts at leniency and reform didn't work.
Well, I think the most telling thing was a statement that she made I guess during her testimony in support of the bill before the committee, before Senate Jude C, that these four-time offenders are getting out on the same calculation used for a first-time nonviolent offender.
Exactly.
And I think that just, if you say that to folks, I think it would strike them all as a little odd, right?
Well,
I mean, how many bites at the apple are you going to get? And why should you be given the same benefit of the doubt and the same hope for rehabilitation and the same hope that you will not recidivate as a four-time loser?
Of course. So, you know, one of the things that you see, a convicted felon with a firearm is a nonviolent offense. It's not listed as a violent offense.
Mm-hmm.
So people that are charged with an aggravated assault, an aggravated battery, an attempt murder, if they plead to a felony crime of violence, they're not going to receive the accelerated parole eligibility or good time provision. So the defendant and the defendant's attorney want to try and plea bargain that to a nonviolent offense. So this is a violent offender that the DA may drop the felony crimes of violence, allow them to plead to, quote unquote, a nonviolent offense like a convicted felon in possession of a firearm, and they will accrue good time at the same rate as somebody that's been convicted of, you know, a low-level, totally nonviolent offense. So I think this bill is, you know, being offered to address some of the issues, because you can't just look at the offense, you have to look at the offender. And most people don't understand the distinction between the two of them. Not all offenders can be classified just by the fact that they're serving time for a nonviolent offense. They need to look at the totality of the circumstances, and I think this bill is being offered to address some of those issues.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and they did so in this article as well. They characterized this justice reinvestment package is necessary because we had the highest rate of incarceration per 100,000 residents, more than Cuba, more than Rwanda. Interestingly, though, I would love to see what the offender rate is in those countries per 100,000 people.
Well, I mean,
because
the other thing,
we never focus on the offender rate here. No one ever, ever mentions offender rates. You know, incarceration is an outcome. And it drives me crazy that we do not focus on offender rates. It's not as though we're running around in law enforcement with nothing to do and we're just, you know, creating charges to charge people with every single solitary day. I mean, it just, we've kind of lost sight of the whole equation. Someone compels something to happen, and that would be the criminal.
So this is framed in the point of how much it costs to keep somebody in jail.
Yeah.
What is the cost of not putting somebody in jail that goes out and commits multiple crimes? That is never addressed out there, but that is a very much a reality. So what we're seeing happening in New Orleans right now is that because of the surge in violent crime, you know, we're losing business. People aren't, you know, people from this city now are going out to Jefferson Parish to shop for groceries, to gas up, to go out to eat, because they don't view it safe in New Orleans right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, unless we get a handle on some of this, and these are issues that are not unique to New Orleans, they're happening in other communities across the state as well, maybe not to the extent of what's going on in New Orleans right now. But I think that we need to also take into consideration not just the cost of incarceration, but the cost of non-incarceration as well. Absolutely. For repeat offenders. Yeah,
absolutely. We'll continue this conversation when we return. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Stay with us, folks. We are back, folks. We're visiting with Rafi Goyeneche, head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, I've got an interesting text here. It says, why is it that the victims are always demonized as if they asked to be attacked? So wrong for attorneys to attack the victims. We're seeing more and more of this where they're trying to destroy the credibility of victims of crime. And I think, you know, in many cases, they've been successful because victim cooperation, certainly over the last decade, has waned.
All right. So the people that attack the credibility of victims are the criminal defense bar and some of the advocacy groups. I don't object to them. You know, they're entitled to their right to do that. That's what a defense attorney is supposed to do, represent their client. Where the problem exists, in my opinion, is when prosecutors prioritize the offender's rights over the rights of victims. And I think that, you know, one of the problems we've seen with our DA in New Orleans is, you know, he came into that office with no background as a prosecutor. And during his first year, I think his eyes have been open, and he's modified a lot of his positions. And going into 2022, I think he has a different approach, a different perspective than when he went into that office in 2021. So I think in many respects, he is recognizing that his clients now are victims and witnesses and the law-abiding citizens, and he's answerable not just to the people that voted for him, but to everybody in the city of New Orleans, even the people that voted for his opponent or didn't go to the polls and vote at all. And I think that what we're seeing from Jason Williams is a different approach in 2022 than he went into that office in 2021. That doesn't mean that I think that he's doing a great job right now. I think he's doing a better job in 2022, but he still has, I think, room to reassess some of his policies to help support the efforts of the police department and, most importantly, to hold people that are responsible for violent felony offenses accountable and remove them from recidivating and continuing to victimize people in this city.
When you think about the in this city, the vast majority of crime is black-on-black crime. And when you look at the socioeconomic strata here, most of the victims are those that are middle-class income wage earners and below, right? A number of which are below the federally identified poverty level. And a lot of times I wonder whether or not we shouldn't spend more time requiring a more robust program and demand that victim impact statements be given in these cases before the individuals are sentenced. Because if you have someone that's living below the federally identified poverty level that's a victim of a theft or a break-in in their vehicle, they're in a much more difficult position than you, me, or others in regrouping, recalculating our lives and moving forward. And I don't think we spend enough time talking about that.
Well, you know, you're right, but I think that the gatekeeper of that, you know, a victim impact statement means that someone has either been convicted or pled guilty, mm-hmm. and now they're before the judge for sentencing. Since most of the convictions are pursuant to guilty pleas, and my comments are more directed at violent felony offenses, so we issue prosecution reports. And we're taking a look at the outcomes of violent felony arrests and how the district attorney's office concludes those violent felony arrests. And what we've seen is that in 2022, only 6% of the violent felony cases that closed, which were 285 through May the 12th, only 18 of those violent felony cases were closed guilty as charged.
Yeah, that's another. I don't mean to cut you off, Rafi, but we got to get to the break. This hour flew by, as always. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk more about that next time. Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
We'll be right back. All right, folks, when we return after the top of the news break, we'll visit with Michael Heck, president and CEO of GNO, Inc., and he brings with him Courtney Williams, founder and CEO of Skills Academy. In the 12 o'clock hour, we'll also talk to Mark Hamrick, Bank Rate Senior Economic Analyst, on the April Retail Report. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the top of the news break. This is Newell on WWL.